One of the fathers of rock and roll has died. With his homemade guitar, Bo Diddley created a sound that left an indelible impression on rock and roll. Bo Diddley passed away this morning in Florida of heart failure. He was 79. He was born Ellis Bates in Mississippi, and he once played that homemade guitar on street corners in Chicago until he was discovered in the mid-1950s. NPR's Ned Ulaby has this appreciation of Bo Diddley.
It's among the most distinctive beats in rock and roll.
Boom, 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 boom.
Scholars trace this pattern to church tambourines, West African drumming, and a hand-padding rhythm called hambone that goes back to slavery. But Bo Diddley told the public radio show American Roots he found it someplace else.
I was trying to play I Got Spurs That Jingle, Jangle, Jingle by Gene Autry.
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
And stumble up on that beat. And here it is.
But in a later interview with Morning Edition, Bo Diddley went from cowboys to Indians.
That was basically an Indian chant. Just picture dancing around a daggone big fire in the middle of them. They're dancing around with their spears. Boom, 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 boom.
Go little side, baby, diamond ring.
Wherever that beat came from, music historian Peter Guralnick says Bo Diddley made it big enough for everyone.
It just was an invitation for people to step into. You know, lots of people imitated it, lots of people carried it on.
Including Eric Clapton, the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and Bruce Springsteen.
It's almost as if he foreshadowed James Brown in the sense in which rhythm predominated over melody and over the usual conventions of pop songwriting. And I think it's a tribute to Bo Diddley that it has lasted as long as it has.
But Diddley said while rhythm was important, the secret to good songwriting lay in something else.
A story with some funny lyrics or some serious lyrics or some love-type lyrics. But you got to think in terms of what people's lives is based on.
I was born one night about 12 o'clock.
Many of Bo Diddley's most famous songs were about Bo Diddley. Diddley was sent to Chicago as a child and adopted by his mother's sister. Deeply religious, she tried to steer the young man from the devil's music with violin lessons. He built violins and guitars at a vocational high school and later met Gene Barge, a staffer at Chess Records.
I mean, if you know Bo Diddley, you'll know that he was a gimmickry guy. He was gifted with his hands. He loved to work on things, cars, record players, amplifiers. He made all of his guitars. He crafted his whole sound.
Some of Diddley's guitars were custom-built to his specifications by the Grudge Company, shaped like stars or covered in fur. Barge said long before Diddley worked audiences, he worked odd jobs and construction.
He told me that he was working one of these air hammers in the middle of the street that makes all this terrible noise.
Bo Diddley drew from the sounds of the Chicago streets where he first performed.
Oh, Diddley had a farm.
Bo Diddley's stage name came from street corner slang.
Bo Diddley means that a guy was something extra special, you know, a real pistol.
Gene Barge says in addition to playing rock, blues inspired by John Lee Hooker, calypso and Latin-tinged tunes, Bo Diddley was something of a comedian. He joined up with a female sideman, the Duchess, and Jerome Green on maracas, who Diddley also credited with inventing that signature beat. Here's Green and Diddley playing in a vernacular called The Dozens.
Hey, man.
What's that, boy?
I want to tell you about your girlfriend.
What about my girl?
But you don't look strong enough to take the message.
I'm strong enough.
I might hurt your feelings.
My feelings already hurt by being here with you.
Say Man was Diddley's last top 20 single. His style of rock eventually fell out of fashion, and Diddley became bitter over how others had profited from his sound. He'd written numerous hits, but sold the rights to pay his bills. His living came from constant touring. Towards the end of Bo Diddley's career, he toyed with rap and even returned, more or less, to his early classical training.
I wrote a concerto that I do on the guitar now. It's called Bo's Concerto. Dun 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 Dun, 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 dun.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Nashville, if you're trying to make it to the big stage like Garth Brooks, you've got to start on the small one, preferably at the Bluebird Cafe.
Sometimes late at night, I lie awake and watch her sleeping.
For 25 years, the Bluebird has built a name for itself by honoring the writers behind those chart-topping faces. Garth Brooks himself was discovered there. 4 times a year, they hold auditions to find new voices for their weekly Sunday Writers Night performances. And I stopped in a few weeks ago to check out the talent.
Now, when you first pull up to the Bluebird Cafe, it's not that impressive. It's nestled between a dry cleaners and a hair salon. I mean, it's basically in a strip mall. And the awning that might have been blue once upon a time is pretty much a battered gray. But what it is hallowed ground for songwriters here in Nashville. And people line up from 2 to 3 hours before the open auditions that happen 4 times a year just to get a chance to play here.
I'm Lindley Wolf Graham, and I got in line around 9 o'clock.
Kenward Cooper from Las Vegas. Been standing in line since 8 o'clock.
Hello, I'm David Seeger. I'm a singer-songwriter from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Now, why stand in front of the Bluebird this early on a Sunday morning?
For a chance to be heard and for a chance to play a legendary venue. You know, the other day I found online a copy of Garth Brooks' audition form where he came and stood right here and auditioned exactly like I'm doing. You know, and Vince Gill played here the 14th. There aren't very many places that somebody like me at the beginning of his career can go and stand on the same stage like these guys.
The Bluebird is miles away from the downtown strip of country western bars. It's on the other side of town from Music Row, the street where all the record labels have offices. Technically, it's a restaurant, but most people can't remember what they've eaten there. They can tell you who they've heard. One night a week, a handful of the city's published singer-songwriters are invited to sit in the middle of the cafe and sing for the audience. They sit in a round, facing each other. The only rule is that they can only sing songs they've written. People waiting in line here this morning are hoping to get into that circle. That would mean something to Jason Witten, a construction boss from Houston.
I think at some point we all kind of want some validation, you know, to know that we're on, at least on the right track, you know, and that we're working towards kind of the same goal is, you know, to put stuff out there that people can relate to, you know, with their everyday lives and knowing that it just came out of our heads and our hearts to know that, yeah, hey, you're doing, you're on the right track. I think some validation is definitely something that we're all probably looking for.
When the original owner retired, the Nashville Songwriters Association International took over the cafe to keep up the tradition and build its membership. Manager Erica Wallum-Nichols says music publishers, producers, pop stars, talent scouts, they're always going to Bluebird shows to discover new writers and new songs. That's why she says these auditions are so important. But each hopeful only gets a minute on stage.
Obviously, a minute worth of song is very, very hard to portray, you know, what you're doing with a song. But within that first minute, you can tell whether somebody's kind of got a handle on rhyme, a handle on painting a picture with a song, a handle on basically where they are in their career.
Once the audition starts, the nervous chatter dies down. Nichols starts calling them to the stage from a row of church pews in the back of the restaurant. Remember Kenward Cooper from Las Vegas?
We need to find a way to lead a secret life and keep it just between us without getting caught.
Here's Lindley Wolf Graham from Minnesota.
Heaven knows it ain't never easy. Lord, I loved him just the same.
And David Seeger got his moment on the same stage as country hero Garth Brooks.
Backfires running on ball ties, egg dish, flow bowls, rust right to the cold, hey, it's a truck. Only
so I hope you were paying attention. because you might have heard the next big country hit.
So this is Redneck Love. Yeah.
The Nashville-based band Be Your Own Pet has been described as punk, garage rock, and just plain fun. They certainly hit all the right notes. Songs about boredom? Check. Songs about zombies? Check. Songs tagged for violent content in a live show that's ended in food fights? Well, I don't know if that qualifies as just plain fun, but we'll check those off the list as well. Their first self-titled album came out in 2006 when they were still in high school. Now the group is back on tour. Lead singer Jamina Pearl and guitarist Jonas Stein join us here in the studio to tell us about their new CD, Get Awkward. Jamina and Jonas, welcome.
Thank you.
So to start off, this isn't exactly the kind of music people might be thinking of when they think of the Nashville sound. So how do you see yourselves fitting in there?
Well, we're very disattached with, like, any idea of what most outsiders think Nashville is, which is, you know,
country
and western. And the only time you really find that is by walking down Broadway and walking into, like, singer-songwriter bars that and charging, like, $10 beers.
And Broadway's that strip downtown where all the sort of honky-tonk bars are and Robert's Western World and kind of the tourist part of Nashville.
Very touristy. There's so many different kinds of music in Nashville, and I think when we were about 13, 14, going to shows for the first time, there was a lot of, like, hardcore and, like, punk bands playing.
They're, like, the little, like, DIY hardcore punk rock scene that was going on at this pizza place called Guido's.
And anyone could go. It was always all ages, which is, like, a rare thing. So that's, like, people are like, punk doesn't exist in Nashville. It's like, well, yeah, it does. It's just people don't know about it. Next year I'll be 21. Look at world, 'cause what happened.
Next year I'll be 21. Look at world, 'cause what happened. One of the things about this album is that it is a lot of fun, and there are some moments in it that sort of remind me of Rock and Roll High School, which was before you were born, but was a movie that involved the punk band The Ramones.
I know. Riff Randall's one of my inspirations and heroes in life, so I definitely know Rock and Roll High School pretty well.
There are moments in the album that remind me of The Ramones, and there's one song that's called Becky that has not been released in the U.S., but very much has a very fun feel to it. We're going to hear a bit of it now. BFF, and you're such a good friend.
I was trying, when I wrote Becky, I just thought about, like, writing a song about all the girls who've done me wrong in the past, like becoming really close friends with girls and kind of getting stabbed in the back, which I think happens a lot, like, especially in, like, middle school and junior high. And I thought, like, it would be funny to, like, take these bad experiences and put it into a song that's, like, kind of silly and, like, referencing, like, old, like, murder ballads from, like, the 60s and 50s. Now I'm going to juvie for teenage homicide.
It would all have been cool if you'd stay by my side. Becky is a song that ends with sort of a knife fight and someone speaking the words from juvenile detention. And it's a song that has been placed on the UK release, the UK album, but not in the US. And can you talk about who made that decision and why?
Not us. The head, like, lawyers at Universal decided that Becky...
And this is Universal Records?
Yeah. And, like, they decided that the three songs, that song Becky, another song Black Hole, and Blow Your Mind, that they were too violent to be on the album, and they gave us the option of either changing the lyrics or taking them off the album. So it was like, we'll take them off the album. But I think mostly what it has to do with is that they feel like our demographic is, like, you know, middle class families, and those are the people who sue labels, and I guess they're worried that someone is going to listen to that song and then take a knife to school and say it's because, you know, of Be Your Own Pet, which is pretty ridiculous, but I guess that's what they're afraid of.
Yeah, if we were, you know, a rap group that was degrading women or talking about popping fools or whatever, it'd be okay to release.
I think that ever since the Columbine High School shooting, there's been a general skittishness about music. And mm-hmm. you guys, it sounds like you sound pretty annoyed that you've been kind of caught in the web of that.
Yeah.
And I guess I was wondering, did you ever have a moment where you thought about changing the lyrics, or you thought about releasing it somewhere else, or sort of what was your, I guess, when you hit the wall with the label, where did you go next?
Well, I mean, I definitely, there's no doubt in my mind that, like, we're definitely not going to change the lyrics, because that would be admitting that there's something wrong with the lyrics, and I definitely don't think there's anything wrong with the lyrics, because if they're saying there's something wrong with the lyrics, it's basically like you're saying there's something wrong with me for having thoughts like this, and I don't think there's anything wrong with people, you know, feeling like having violent ideas. I mean, I think writing a song about it, it's much better than acting out those thoughts. You know, it helps you deal with things.
After we spoke to Be Your Own Pet members Jamina Pearl and Jonah Stein, we contacted the Universal Music Group to ask why they had cut the three songs from the American release of Get Awkward. They declined comment, but simply stated this: as we do with all of our artists, we respect their positions on their music and the artistic integrity that they bring to every project. We look forward to a long and successful relationship with Be Your Own Pet. Jamina and Jonas did tell us that Universal agreed to release the master tapes of the songs cut from the American CD, and on Tuesday, they'll be available as digital releases on the independent label XL Recordings. You can hear their infamous song, Becky, on our website, npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
Back now with Day to Day. Tighter is a one-man singing sensation from the Faroe Islands. These are islands clustered between Iceland and Norway, tucked up there in the North Atlantic. Our music critic Christian Bordahl happens to be from that area. He was born in Norway. And so Christian brought Tighter into our studios here at NPR West to talk and play some songs off his new album, The Singer.
I'm in love with a girl I don't know.
Tighter says the Faroe Islands are an idyllic place for kids to grow up.
Very small islands, actually. You can always sort of see the water wherever you are. And it's quite isolated from the rest of the world.
As he grew older, however, the isolation began to feel like confinement. And at age 17, he moved with his family to Denmark.
And it just seemed like a good idea at the time. I was a teenager, I was bored, and I wanted to play music and go somewhere else.
Though he no longer lives on the Faroes, Tighter has maintained a close connection to his homeland. And on his new album, The Singer, he's harnessed some of the bleak iconoclasm and introspection that resides in those far-flung reaches of the Scandinavian soul.
You got sapphire eyes, and that's okay. I've seen that before, it's nothing new. You can look at me that way if you want, but don't let me fall in love with you.
The Singer is Tighter's third English language album, and it was recorded on yet another picturesque Scandinavian island called Gotland, where he even found some local musicians to add to the mix.
We found out that there was a great brass band in Gotland. And then we just set up a girls' choir. We found also this musician that lived on Gotland. That's amazing. He'd done a lot of the music for the Pippi Longstockings. You know, because that was all shot on Gotland. All those TV series, the Pippi Longstockings.
Ingmar Bergman also lived on a tiny island off the northern tip of Gotland for much of his life, and shot some of his movies there. And a melancholic, Bergman-like fascination with relationships and the human condition pervades the stories on The Singer.
It's still the same, nothing has changed. We still drink the same water. It's still the same, nothing has changed. We still drink the same water.
When he joined me in the studio at NPR West, Titer played the title track from his new record. With its mixture of direct storytelling, subtle humor, and musical minimalism, the song sets the tone for the rest of the album.
I always had the voice, and now I am a singer. The audience grows silent when I open up my mouth. I sing about my loneliness, and in return they thank me. I'd never meant to be singer, but I'm slowly getting used to the idea.
On his new album, Titer channels a Scandinavian vibe into slow, often dark songs that can feel more like musical fragments because of their sparse instrumentation and lack of traditional pop song structure. But if you're willing to go with him to that quiet, sometimes beautiful, sometimes harsh, contemplative place, he'll make it worth your effort. Ooh-hoo. Oh, and he has managed to squeeze in this one light, upbeat pop number called
Catherine the Waitress.
For NPR News, this is Christian Bordahl.
If you only knew where my mind is.
That's Titer. His latest CD is called The Singer, and to hear the songs he played live in our studio, go to npr.org/music.
What the film Sideways did for Pinot Noir, Juno did for a genre of music called anti-folk. If you saw the film, you'll be familiar with this song by the band Moldy Peaches.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else but
I'll kiss you on the brain in the shadow of the train.
Forget Woody Guthrie or Peter Paul and Mary. Anti-folk doesn't have to be harmonious, though it can be. It doesn't even have to be musical or political or relevant. It just has to be different.
An appreciation for creativity over technique. What's more important is whether you're really coming up with something interesting and creative and unique.
That's Jeffrey Lewis. He's a performer at the heart of the anti-folk movement in New York City. In fact, he's so anti-folk, he denies being part of it. Here's a song from his album City and Eastern Songs. It's called Don't Be Upset.
I took my darling out to the aquarium. Sea creatures stared at us and we stared back at them. My baby freaked when she peeked at that eight-legged blob with a beak. She was too scared to speak. I said, don't be upset, it's only an octopus. Don't bother it and I'm sure it won't bother us. Please don't be upset, my darling, please don't get upset.
At 33, Jeffrey Lewis has already produced 18 albums. He also draws and writes a comic book series. Lewis is now on tour promoting his new album, 12 cover songs of the 70s punk band Crass. We caught up with him earlier this week in St. Paul, Minnesota. Jeffrey Lewis, I saw a review that called your music bizarre but brilliant.
Well, hey, I'll take it. I don't know, I feel like New York City sort of has a history of not quite fitting in to what's going on musically in the rest of the country or in the rest of the world. I mean, you know, the weird 60s bands that came out of New York from Silver Apples and the Velvet Underground and the Fugs, none of which, you know, seemingly fits in stylistically with each other except for the fact that there's somehow this it's just a New York City thing of you know, a sort of ragtag collection of musical misfits, and it's kind of a New York City tradition, and that's part of the, you know, the wording of that album title, City and Eastern Songs. I kind of thought of it as, well, maybe it is sort of a genre into itself. If country and western is a genre, then New York should be called City and Eastern.
And New York is so present in so much of what you write about and sing about. There's a song that you wrote called The History of Development of Punk Rock on New York's Lower East Side from 1950 to 1975. It's an epic title, a nine-minute song. I wish we could play the whole thing, but let's just hear a bit of it for a moment.
We start with Harry Smith in 1950, a beatnik weirdo living in New York City. His huge collections were insane, of Easter eggs and paper airplanes and rare records. He had about 1,000,060. To change America through music was his hope, and to make some money because he was broke, he compiled a triple-decker collection of songs from his records, released as the Smithsonian Anthology of American Folk.
On a Monday morning, just about 9 o'clock, the great ship Titanic began to reel and rock. Husbands and wives, little children lost their lives. Wasn't it sad when that went down.
Smith's plan began to work as foretold. This weird music began to take hold. It sparked an interest in these forms of life underground from the norms, and soon millions of folk records were being sold. By the early 60s, Dylan Bio's Phil Oaks were doing intellectualized copies of the old folks. Then one strange folk band downtown called the Holy Modal Rounders began to make it more anarchistic with weird voices and drug jokes.
Mom's out there switching in the kitchen, and dad's in the living room fussing and a bitching. I'm out here kicking the gong for euphoria, euphoria. When your mind starts reeling and walking.
This song is really a history lesson, in a sense. It goes through all the phases of the development of punk.
Well, I've been really into incorporating history into the stuff that I do, whether it's in the comic books that I make or in the songs or in these things that I call low-budget videos, where I sort of have illustrations that go along with the songs. And I have this History of Communism project I've been working on for a while. It's like a multi-part illustrated rhyming full-color history of communism. So at any given concert, I might do one or two chapters of that.
And you sing, but you also draw comics to go along with these songs.
Yeah, well, I mean, the comic books I've been making my whole life, since I've gotten involved in making music, I've got about 25 of these done now over the last couple of years. I'm sort of singing these songs and my band is playing, but rather than playing my guitar for those songs, I'm sort of flipping through these drawings that go along with the stories that I'm singing.
But are they two different people, the comic book artist and the recording musician?
I think in both there is a sense of substance over surface that I, you know, never set out to be a particularly flashy illustrator. I have a real kind of practical, get-the-job-done approach to the artwork. But comics are just such an antisocial form of creativity. You're just alone in your room for hours and hours working on them, whereas music, you actually get to bring what you do out to the public and sort of run around the world doing it.
Jeffrey Lewis, there's a song that you sing. It's called The Williamsburg Will Oldham Horror, and I guess it's about taking the subway to remaster an album of yours. You run into the singer Will Oldham. He's not exactly a household name. So first, can you explain who Will Oldham is?
Well, Will Oldham is a household name in the world of independent folk, I guess you could say. He's a very quirky and somewhat mysterious character who changes his name every few albums, so it's a little hard to keep up with him. But he has a massive, massive following. He's what a lot of people look to as the standard bearer of weird, quirky folk stuff, I guess you could say.
Jeffrey Lewis, before we talk more about the song, I want to play some of it because it's such an interesting song.
I said, Will, buying Prince Palace, whatever, what do you think about it? Is it worth being an artist or an indie rock star? Are you better off without it? Because, you know, maybe the world would be better if we were all just uncreative drones. No dead childhood dreams to haunt us, a decent job, a decent home. And if we had some extra time, we could do real things to promote peace. Become scientists or history teachers or uncorrupt police at least. Come on, Will, you gotta tell me. I grabbed and shook him by the arm. The L train was leaving Bedford with 10,000 white 20-somethings crowded on.
The lyric that we just heard, you're asking, is it worth being an artist or an indie rock star, or are you better off without it? Because, I mean, maybe the world would be better off if we were all just uncreative drones. Jeffrey Lewis, there's a theme in a lot of your music, a sort of a struggle with your own identity and the kind of anxiety that comes with that struggle.
Well, I think any artist might have, well, I don't know if any, but at least for myself, I guess I should say, there's this question of, well, okay, here I am actually surviving just, you know, from making these comic books and making these songs and these other projects? And am I actually doing something for the world? I mean, do I really deserve to survive off of this? And, you know, an artist or an entertainer is not somebody who's lobbying for better environmental laws or being a neighborhood pediatrician or who knows what, you know, a pro bono lawyer for tenants who need help with their rent, being a teacher. You know, there's obviously all kinds of good things you can actually do with your life. And being an artist is a dream for so many people. And then once you're sort of on that path, for myself, I find there's a, you know, am I actually doing enough in the world? And I've, you know, and also just my own personal anxieties of, you know, do I even deserve to exist as a human being? Which I don't know how much of that is down to just being a neurotic New York Jewish guy or how much of that is, you know, a widespread phenomenon among all humans in this day and age.
I lay down every night, I can't get no rest, 'cause it starts spinning in my brain and then it's pounding in my chest. What if I've wasted all my youth? What if I've wasted growing up? What if I've wasted my whole life? Oh man, I feel like throwing up. It's an anxiety attack, an anxiety attack. I've got a bad case of the horrors, and at night it comes back.
I wonder if the lyrics are more important to you than the way the music sounds.
I think at its heart, a song has to have content, and no amount of glossy surface or expensive production or fancy singing, to me, makes up for just having a real heart and something to say.
Do you feel like you have to say something in all of your songs?
I do feel a certain responsibility that, you know, if I'm going to be presenting my material to people, then, you know, there should actually be some real content to it. And a lot of art, not that it necessarily has to be nonfiction by any means, but I do have a sense of, you know, it really needs to mean something to me if I'm going to find it worthwhile to actually create.
Jeffrey Lewis is a singer, songwriter, and comic book artist from New York. Jeffrey Lewis, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
To hear more songs by Jeffrey Lewis and to see some of his drawings, go to npr.org/music.
And I used to feel so smart, you know, I used to feel so strong, but this just can't be how to live, I must be doing something.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Andrea Seabrook returns next week. Have a good night.